CliffCentral.com.
We started a brand new show on CliffCentral.com a short while ago. It's called The Maid Sessions, and it's terrific. It's doing something that nobody else has ever done before. It's the brainchild of the two ladies sitting in front of me now, Mbalin Jomani and Tuliza Sindi. And these two have decided to put together an incredible collection of stories, of revelations, of conversations, of amazing experiences from women who work as domestic workers. And across South Africa, this is a huge number of people who are not necessarily unionized, who don't necessarily have the same rules applying to them across the board, some of whom are very happy and satisfied in their work and feel it gives them meaning, some who are deeply unhappy and are really just doing it for the money, some who have to put up with awful treatment, some who feel like they have a second family in the family of the people that they work for. Sometimes the relationships, though complicated with the children of the madams that they work for, can lead to all kinds of very, very strange personal feelings, situations, complications. A lot of this is stuff that most people just don't want to talk about from both sides. And some people are deeply, I think, hurt that their mothers who work as domestic workers are doing undignified work, where sometimes that's not how the person in question actually feels. It's a very deep, dark South African place to go.
Absolutely.
And Bali, why the hell did you decide to open this can of worms? Couldn't you just shut up and kept to yourself? Tuliza, for God's sake, why?
Well, first of all, because we like cans of worms. we have a penchant for them. But also just because, you know, this is an important conversation to have if we're to evolve as a society. We can't have so many voiceless people, right? And I think, you know, it's a long story, but I used to, for 5 years I worked in social entrepreneurship, and then got really bored in my last job, and decided to take a writing sabbatical, because somewhere along the line of avoiding my work, I decided I was a writer, so I decided to take the sabbatical, but I needed to sustain my social upkeep, so I needed to find a way to make money, so I didn't become a complete recluse, right? And I wanted to find a way to make money that still gave me the time and the mental energy to focus on writing. And at the same time, I wanted to figure out how to write for social impact. So I decided to become an au pair. Mm-hmm. And never in my wildest dreams did I think my mission to write and being an au pair would intersect. But then, through being an au pair, I started to develop very close relationships with domestic workers, because essentially as an au pair, they do half your job. And I started to see their position from the perspective of a domestic worker or employee rather than that of employer. And it really kind of turned my brain on its head, because I realized actually for the first time, even as somebody who has always prided themselves on getting to know their domestic worker and treating them like a person, right? I realized there was so much more to them than just being domestic workers. That these were women, and they represented a demographic in our country that I think is voiceless. And also I realized what a powerful position they hold in our society. And so I wanted to help them to both share and to take over their narrative, because I think we've very much written their narrative for them because of the work they do. And that has its roots in our self-interest. And, you know, it even has its roots in slavery, right? But that's, you know, maybe we'll go into that later. But basically I wanted, this gave me the opportunity as somebody who wants to write for impact to establish a new narrative for a group that I think is immensely valuable, but underrepresented.
And I mean, she had highlighted it in the first show that they very strong socioeconomic factor in our society.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have such an intimate story and relationship with that role. I mean, I've never had a domestic worker. So even the term maid is something really interesting that I'm discovering in this country. And I'm not originally South African. So there's a lot of nuances that I'm experiencing along with every other listener. But as an architect, I've always experienced such huge social injustices that play themselves out, and particularly in that role. And I think it's also very easy for us in very personal spaces to speak with a lot of bravery and confidence about the ways that we perceive society. And then when we go outside, we speak a different thing. But what's wonderful about domestic workers and their ability to be invisible in spaces is that they hear all those things. Mm. They hear us when we feel brave, and they hear us when we feel insecure in public space.
Absolutely.
So they're an amazing source to tap into for someone that sees us in all our different conditions.
And they're intimately involved in very powerful people's lives. Yeah. I mean, presidents have domestic workers.
Absolutely. Yeah.
CEOs have domestic workers.
They're really something we all have in common. And it's hard to find that in South Africa, to find a third party that we all have in common. And I think that third party can be empowered to bridge some of the gaps we need to in terms of nation building.
And in terms of race relations, too.
Absolutely.
I mean, because, you know, domestic workers work equally for black and white people.
Right.
But They're treated as kind of different to both.
Right.
But what I think is wonderful about their role is that they're a reflection of the repercussions of a bad act.
Yes.
Every single day they are a reminder of the repercussions. So it's very difficult to simply say the past was the past, because they're a constant reminder. They are in your most intimate of spaces. And Even their silence is a reflection on, you know, their silence or lack of participation in your confidence in saying statements about the country is a reflection on the silence or the censoring of certain conditions. So very interesting.
All right, let's talk about you two before we get into the maid sessions. So first of all,
we don't have to.
Mbali is Xhosa. You're from the Eastern Cape, but you are a law school dropout.
Indeed.
Right, me too.
So.
Me too.
More
nothing
power.
To be embarrassed about.
Absolutely
that.
Absolutely not. Something to be proud of.
Right.
On the contrary.
You mentioned the writing already, so we'll talk about that a little bit later on too.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, you could easily have just become an academic, because your brain is wired that way too. I mean, you seem to me to be one of those people who could quite easily become like a professor of sociology.
Except
or something
that
like
I couldn't,
that.
You know?
Why?
As much as my brain is wired academically, I'm just too much of a humanist.
And a bit of an activist.
And a bit of an activist, yeah. I mean, for me, I don't know. There's something about like academic papers that's incredibly dormant. And so I studied law because I knew I'd be good at it. And because to some extent, I like the way that lawyers are taught to think, right? To spot the loopholes. And I think that could be used for good. What I don't like, however, and what I realized very soon, is that law can be very rigid, and also it can be interpreted to suit one side. And it's much like religion in that sense. It can be manipulated. And that didn't sit well with me, and I didn't like it. And so that was the activist in me pushing back against something that was very academic, something I was naturally good at, but... you know, so many things were just unconscionable for me, and I've never been the kind of person who can do anything that's unconscionable.
What kind of a kid were you at school?
Oh, God, no.
Serious?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Not at all.
Good, because I wasn't going to say that.
No, I mean, people find this ironic. People are surprised. I was never an academic achiever. I didn't care to be.
You were probably smart enough to coast.
Coast. And the teachers, you know, I had a love-hate relationship with my teachers as a result, because they knew that I knew that I
that I could get by
on doing very little, right?
Right?
And what I was preoccupied with in high school, because I wasn't an attractive adolescent, right? So it was very hard for me to become popular. And so every day, systematically, I figured out how to go from the bottom to the top of the pecking order. And really everything else, including my academic work, was extracurricular.
But for you, it was like getting to the top. So were you at the top by the time you finished?
Absolutely.
And were you a mean girl?
No, not at all.
No,
I was
a lot
activist.
Of girls, when they get to the top, they become mean.
I was an activist. I remember I will forever be notorious at my high school. My shame, bless. Anyway, I'll forever be notorious for the one day a girl was racist. There was a slur. What did she say? She said the K word. She said Kappa.
Oh.
I don't know, she woke up on the wrong side of the bed. That's usually the excuse.
Yeah. did she say it to you?
No, not to me. It was hearsay. I heard through the grapevine.
All right.
But, you know, I was on it, and I was very indignant, and I wrote a letter to the principal, and nothing happened. And they tried to just kind of to pacify us and to make it go away. And I was not having that at all, because I thought that there should be disciplinary action, but that wasn't going to happen. So I took it into my own hands. I rallied all of the black girls. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, very peacefully marched around her just to make a statement. And literally...
what happened?
The school, the whole school stopped. You know, they called an emergency assembly. She was made to write a letter to apologize publicly. There was then disciplinary action. There was a long apology on the part of the principal for ignoring the whole matter. And
were you happy with that result when it eventually did get to that?
Was I happy with that result? Yes. It just was frustrating to me that it had to take something like that.
Yeah. But you see, that's often what happens is people are just, they're willing to be complacent. Oh, don't worry, this will blow over, right?
Yeah. Mm.
And it's not just in race relations, it's in a lot. I mean, we look at unemployment in this country, we look at all kinds of other things.
But the other thing
people are just, they're happy to kind of, oh, it'll get better.
No, but the other thing I don't like is people who try to diffuse the matter. And so that, in large part, what the principal did was, because, you know, our school uniform is blue. She was like, oh, no, there's no black and white in the school. We are all blue.
Mm.
And so that really pissed me off.
Right.
Because for me, what that was saying, she wasn't acknowledging the problem. And I think that's part of what we're in the culture of doing in this country, as all these, you know, politically
okay.
correct
I'm going to put you in her position, because this is an interesting and instructive story for a lot of us.
Okay.
So now you're the principal. Mm. And I come to you and I go, listen, this chick is going around using the K word. Mm. You got to sort this shit out. What are you going to say? What are you going to do, more importantly? How do you approach this?
Set up a forum and use this as an opportunity to probe into something that actually might be relevant for the curriculum. It could be like historical and academic, and use it as an opportunity. I'd turn it into a debate and have it in front of the whole school.
I think we need racial rehab.
Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But there are ways you can do that in that environment. You can use education because it has that power.
Right.
And it has the power to make things civilized.
Yeah.
It didn't have to, you know, what I did was extreme. It didn't need to be the case. She could have used it as an educational opportunity, and she didn't.
You you probably also were then branded a troublemaker, even though all you were trying to do was
sort
things out.
I mean, and you know, I had a lot of white friends back then. No.
I have black friends too. Don't say it like that.
And I think for 3 weeks they looked at me, they just with such fear in their eyes, like I was gonna pull out a gun or something.
But you know what, this is what's happening on social media too now. And some of it is absolutely required. I liked what you just said now, Tulisa, about racial rehab.
Mm.
It's kind of like when you've got an alcoholic and you need to get off the source.
Mm.
You need to go through a 12-step program. We need to work out what that 12-step program for race relations
is. Absolutely.
Huh?
Yeah.
Agreed.
I mean, I tried to do that actually as well with my teaching and some of my colleagues, because, you know, I've got some very white colleagues and I've got some...
some very white ones.
Very white.
Very, very white ones. And we've actually started establishing not just relations between myself and them, but between ourselves and the students, because they're finding that they're really, really struggling to know how to teach students that are so socially aware. Because we, I think, I'm sort of 3 or 4 years older than some of these students, and yet the degree with which they really understand the very intricate nuances of social justice and inequality and bigotry and those sort of things is a lot higher than any generation before them.
Mm.
So we really are trying to find ways to engage with them, but it has to be on their terms a lot more than them on our terms, whilst, you know, the sort of social orders of, you know, power would tell you that the younger ones have to
learn from the older ones.
Yeah.
Okay, so tell me about you.
Do you want to read something?
No, I know you're an architect.
So I'm an architect, but I really struggle with the architecture industry. It's extremely white male dominated at the moment.
But even if it wasn't, the projects aren't always exciting, are they?
Yeah. I don't even know who writes the briefs, but that is problematic to begin with. And I actually just recently met two of the sort of top individuals that write a lot of the briefs for Johannesburg in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And they even write parts of the mayor's speech, you know, to sort of tell us, where Johannesburg is heading. Right. And that's how powerful they are. And they're two white Afrikaans people from Pretoria, you know, so very realistically, for them to understand what almost 90% of a country needs, or just a majority of the city needs, I think is a bit unrealistic and to some extent unfair on them as well. Because they are in a position where they have to know, but how will they know?
Yeah, but I mean, you know, 90% of people who are not architects are not necessarily going to do any better just because they're black.
I absolutely agree. I absolutely agree. But I just think we are sort of struggling to have the right conversations in our industry because our industry is extremely fixed. You know, yeah. it's moving in a very particular direction.
And architecture does. It has rules and ways that you do things. And obviously there's a huge amount of creativity in architecture too. But it's about spaces, right?
But it's also about psychology is what I'm learning a lot from Talisa.
Yeah.
She's very – I honestly – you know, I never thought of architects as, in many ways, social interventionists since I met Talisa, because she's taught me how, you know, the built environment tells a story and how if you're out of touch with, if your design philosophy is out of touch with the context, that whatever you build is unsustainable. So you have these dichotomies then where you walk into town and the people and the populace don't match, you know, the buildings, and it's like these strange things that happen, you know, and also how space really impacts on your psychology. And I think what I said to her once was missing for me from the architecture curriculum, not that I know anything about it, but I'm just like, you know, quite overzealous, it's something on psychology, is a psychology course, because I think just that fundamental understanding of human psychology, even if you're not a black person, as a white African architect, if you have that kind of background and that understanding, it would
help you figure it out better.
And I mean, even on a macro scale, if we just look at apartheid planning and how they used to use highways and train tracks and those sort of things
to separate people.
Yeah, to separate and also to prevent growth. And also the limitation of vegetation in certain areas versus other areas, all those sort of things, not just economically affect you, but psychologically and physically affect you as well. And so, and also the idea of having to, people of color and marginalized people often having to go outside of their space to access resource.
Yes.
Versus, I guess, whiteness. I'll just use that term. Being in spaces where resources
are.
She's
a real social justice warrior. This, I can tell.
You're Gareth's favorite.
But being in spaces where resources already are. So there's an immediate association to resources belonging to you if it is a part of your space versus ones that need to trick to access resource. So all those sort of things play into what it is that we perceive of space every single day.
And obviously also in architecture, there's a huge amount of this that's about convenience. Just taking from your last point, you know, if you don't have the spaces around you that are convenient for you to use, then they're not useful to you at all. You may as well move somewhere else or build something else.
Absolutely.
And architects, unfortunately, the only ones who can help us to do that. You know, unless you're prepared to build without a plan and and your house collapses in on you or something.
Absolutely.
Well, 90% of the world's buildings are built by non-architects. Yes. and even there's this one guy that's always thrown around in probably every architecture school, Le Corbusier, but he's said to be sort of the most revolutionary architect of our time, and he wasn't an architect. So I think we shouldn't presume that we cannot do architectural things, or we cannot design social conditions and environments because we are not architects.
And speaking of, actually, I think we found often that domestic workers through our conversations are spatial thinkers. We're all spatial thinkers. Yeah. We just don't realize it. And what they refer a lot to is their isolation and the way that their rooms, their quarters are designed, and how, you know, there's small windows and oftentimes they're facing a wall. And one of the domestic workers said to us, when she goes to the clinic every Friday, she is shocked by the number of women, domestic workers, who are there because they're depressed. You know, and look, it's a cultural thing, so they probably don't call it depression, but she said high blood pressure and stress is the number one reason that they're there.
So that's it.
Yeah, and that's a spatial thing. And that's
but even the word domestic, you know, at the beginning of domestic worker, it refers to a house. It refers to a space where people live.
Exactly.
All right, let's talk about the maid sessions for a second. This show, you talk to domestic workers, but you talk to them in ways that they're not used to being spoken to. You ask them for their, and I mean by society at large, you ask them their opinions in politics. You ask them about what they think of you know, the possible sacking of the finance minister.
Right.
You ask them, and they all have answers.
Absolutely.
And these are not people who, you know, don't know what's going on in the world. Mm. And these are not people who don't have smartphones.
Yeah.
What have you learned that shocked you the most about the level of conversation? Because these people are also tremendous networkers. They know who and where and when and why more than almost anybody else in a neighborhood.
Exactly.
It's not even their neighborhood necessarily, but they know everything about it.
These women have intelligence on our society that they don't even realize.
Yeah.
You know, and often we'd speak to them and they'd surprise themselves by how they answered when engaged on a certain level.
Give me an example.
You know, we asked them to make a comparison between Zuma and Mugabe, because a lot of the women we speak to are Zimbabwean.
Mm-hmm.
And at first they were scared because they didn't think it was their place. And they also were terribly afraid that somehow Robert Mugabe was going to hear us and, you know...
Everyone's shitting themselves for Robert Mugabe,
exactly.
Right?
And we were going to be invaded.
In Zim, the consequences are very, very serious.
It's true. They were really genuinely afraid that telepathically he was going to hear us and we'd be invaded. So they shied from it. But when we really probed and we reassured them that they were safe, they began to draw, you know, really intellectual parallels and conclusions. And you could see in their faces... they were surprised by, and they grew, I think, in conviction and indignation, the safer they started to feel. Mm. So I'd say that what I've learned, and I hate platitudes, and this is going to sound like a platitude, but never underestimate someone, right? Mm. And if you can help it, don't estimate, period.
No, but we can't help it. We're pattern-seeking mammals, and we're going to do it. It's the only way we can figure out
an
environment.
I agree, but it's just... it's so counter-evolutionary.
I know. That's why we're stuck. That's exactly why we're stuck. So they'll tell you, for example, where they would say Mugabe and Zuma have things in common.
Mm.
And they'll tell you where they think that they're very, very different.
Mm.
There are a lot of extremely well-educated women from Zimbabwe who have to take up work as domestic workers.
Absolutely.
Some of them are scientists. Some of them are...
Yes.
I mean, you know, they can't all get work in their chosen profession because there just isn't that much work out there.
Mm.
So they end up doing this as the fallback.
Mm.
Do you find that a lot of these women are intellectually frustrated with how dreary and dumb the work is?
Well... What I was quite surprised by, because all of them are very intelligent, well-educated women, but what their role made them do is it really numbed them. So it maybe before they might have felt that way, but they got so used to the role and possibly being there for a very, very long period of time that
it dulled them.
Yes, it completely dulled them. And that's what I found very unfortunate. So it was very interesting when we were going through the conversations with them that they would tell us that it was reviving a lot of aspects to them that they sort of killed off for the sake of being, I guess, keeping their sense of sanity in that role. So, and it's a form of survival. You know?
And the sort of thing I think we've done with this role and many roles is that we've turned them into an identity. So domestic worker goes beyond just a job description, right? It's something they begin to identify as. And that's why, and most people think that domestic worker and, I don't know, intellectual are mutually exclusive things. And through the work and the way that
don't
we treat...
Don't you think that's dangerous? Because
extremely dangerous.
I mean, it's really bad that domestic worker is an identity. I don't think that's a very happy identity for anyone to have.
No, it's terrible. But it can be. It's also... I don't think work is a happy identity, period. I think we're all multidimensional. We should
No one, even if you're doing great work, wants to be just their work.
But I think that's why it's also great to address the uniform.
Yes, I mean you've spoken about that quite a lot too. So let's talk about this. You have yet to meet a domestic worker who loves wearing that stupid uniform.
Not a single one.
Not one. Why do we do it? I don't, by the way. I'm very...
I'm so proud of you.
I allow... There's a guy who works for me. He can wear dress up in whatever he wants. And he's a guy.
Look at that. You're so progressive.
And he can wear whatever the hell he wants. I've never told him not to.
No, absolutely.
None of my business.
And that's how he tells me
what to do when I come to work.
That's how we grew up as well. I mean, we never had a domestic worker with a uniform. But I think that...
But you did have a domestic worker. So no, I need to understand this too. Because there's an extra interesting dynamic here that usually the stereotypical view is white family that say things like, as she's part of the family and all that stuff.
Which is dangerous, by the way.
Exactly. Because if she's part of the family, then give her a pension and give her a put her in the will. Exactly. It creates, and all that.
It creates a false expectation when you call someone family and then you don't treat them that way.
Not only that, but these white families, and then the maid is part of the family and she's... You know, she raised my children and everybody loves her and she's so fantastic and I can't live a day without her. And some of that's true.
Mm-hmm.
But it's more complicated in some ways for a black family who employ a domestic worker, because there's a huge amount of like guilt and there's pain and there's like a... Am I making myself better than you? Do you feel worse than me?
An overcompensation. Do you know
what
this kindness,
what is that all about?
Guilt is doing. Funny enough, increasingly, as we become successful as black people and we have these contradictions that exist in our homes, is that it's creating a dynamic where you create an even bigger distance between yourself and your domestic worker. Because you're consumed.
Because it's so uncomfortable.
Because it's so uncomfortable and you actually recognize
the
irony. So I've worked as an au pair for families where, geez, I find like it's even worse than with the white families, you know. And I don't want to implicate myself.
No, but I understand this because it is. I mean, it would be, you know, in England, for example, in the 1800s, rich families would have huge armies of white servants, and there had to be, in order for them to actually make it work, there was a master and servant distinction. So that's the only way they got through it, with class. They separated people in class. You would call the servants by their surname, and they would live downstairs, and you would only see them when they were useful to you or when they were doing something to keep your house tidy. And the master and the rest of the family would be treated differently. And you do almost the two just they were living parallel lives.
It's deeply troubling, and I'll speak for myself as a black woman who is progressive, who still has a domestic worker, and she, you know, she's not my domestic worker. She's never been. She's always been my mother's.
She doesn't belong to anyone. just by the way.
That's true, actually. she's always my mother's employee.
You're disgusting me. Yeah.
She's an employee.
Right.
I mean,
right. She's an employee. But this is what, I mean, like, in a perfect world, in an ideal world, the word servant wouldn't even be a necessarily bad one.
No, exactly.
Because you're there to be of service.
Exactly.
I employ you. I'm paying you money. If I need you to bake a cake, or if I need you to clean the floors, or if I need you, that's your job. And it's a job, it's a skill set that certain people would pay a lot of money to have available to them. It's like having a personal assistant.
Absolutely.
It's just a personal assistant in the house. So in an ideal world where there wasn't race, there wasn't class, this would not be a problem.
It wouldn't be a problem, as well as if we treated it with more dignity.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the problem and part of the guilt.
No, if we stop the hypocrisy, and I think this is why your show is going to make a huge difference, and it's going to make the splash that I think it will.
Thank you.
It's because you're going to reveal these hypocrisies. We're all going to look in the mirror, and we're going to go, this is what we've got to change.
Mm.
See, if you have a domestic worker, and you feel superior to her, and she feels inferior to you, massive problems.
Yeah.
You avoid each other.
You do.
You don't know what
to
do.
That's exactly what happens.
She doesn't know what to do. You're not sure how to address each other. You make her wear a uniform she doesn't want to wear. You make her do work that you wouldn't ask anyone to do.
You've got to dehumanize her to be able to live with yourself.
Stop the hypocrisy.
Yeah.
But I think we've got to a somewhat unhealthy relationship with private space.
Mm.
Because, you know, it's sort of societal expectations.
That's
right,
your architect. Your fault. You architect.
Facial
because,
doctor.
Because the domestic worker, the domestic worker is in the madam's underwear drawer.
Yeah.
Right? A place not even her husband probably goes.
Oh, my goodness.
Goes.
Exactly. It's you, Talisa.
Really? Oh, okay. Okay. But this is why I sort of strive to practice architecture in this way, because I think the narratives are a bit skewed at the moment, right? Because we create narratives, right? We create narratives when we draw something on paper. We hope that this narrative plays out when we build this building.
Right.
And at the moment, that is what is skewed.
All right. So what narrative should we be drawing?
To be honest, I have no idea, and I...
Come on, woman. You've got to help us here. You're not helping.
But I love that this show is helping us build a healthy one. So I can't act like I know, but I know what we shouldn't be doing. And it's a lot of what our industry is currently doing. You know, like at the moment, I've been working with a lot of these sort of most powerful Johannesburg developers that mm-hmm. own so many of the buildings that have rich histories in themselves. You know, there's such an interesting reason why these buildings were abandoned, why there's mm-hmm. so much potential in the city and those sort of things. And all all everyone wants to do is gentrify it, because that's sort of, we understand the level of success that gentrification can give us. So unfortunately, we have industries that will still fall on the things that we know will work.
Mm-hmm.
I think our country can't really afford to do that right now.
I have a narrative for you.
Okay.
Let's just stop shitting where we eat.
Yeah, you don't like that, huh? You say we're just primitive apes and we shit where we eat and we've got to stop doing that.
You know, let's start treating these women as partners, as co-parents, and realize the immense value that they bring to our lives. And we interviewed... So here's what's really stuck with me that I've heard recently through our sessions is an interview we did with Lindiwe Shibambo, who was a domestic worker and now is a successful businesswoman. She... started a placement agency for domestic workers. She's placed over 1,000 of them, and she trains and she empowers them in many ways, and she really dignifies the work. You know, she really and she covers both sides. She protects both the domestic worker and the employer, and she's very balanced about that, right? And we asked her to try and articulate what she thinks is the power of domestic workers for our country, and she said that her husband was raised by a domestic worker. His mother was a domestic worker. And he often says that the reason they didn't grow up with much, and he grew up around a lot of crime, but the reason he stayed away from crime was through this woman's strength of mind and character, mm-hmm. right? And she highlighted how important women empowerment is to community building.
It's the civilizing effect.
Absolutely.
Where women have... any kind of empowerment and determinism for themselves, everything improves.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And she said, to fight crime in this country, for instance, you don't need a million billboards. What you need is to begin in household South Africa.
Right.
And this is where these women can have the most influence and the most positive impact. And this is why I think they can be empowered to be change agents and to make everything better for all of us. And this is why I'm saying, do not shit where you eat.
And I mean, she's got access to not just her family, but other families.
Absolutely.
So,
It's amazing how connected to, we mentioned this already, but how connected to the whole world a domestic worker is. She has access to places that no one else has.
Yes.
She has an opportunity to share that information or not, as she decides. She knows where all the secrets are. If there's an affair in the house, she knows before the wife knows.
If you want to build or destroy South Africa, rally the domestic workers. That's all I'm going
to
say.
But what I found so beautiful is that the ones that we've been talking to have no bitterness.
No.
They don't care to do wrong by anyone. They do sincerely just care for
because
the goodness
these are,
of
these
everyone.
Are mothers and sisters and wives, and they're just trying to make a
and
living.
And they step into that role of mother. They don't just do what they're paid for. They go above and beyond, and it's their instinct to do that.
Mm.
Look, I think that the show is fantastic. I can't wait for every episode. And I'm looking forward to hearing more and more from both of you. It's been terrific just to kind of scratch the surface and get to know either of you. And I hope that also we'll get to know some of these women who are absolutely changing society at its base and who are responsible for so many of us in so many ways being the people that we are.
And
we were all raised by a domestic worker, right?
Absolutely.
Everyone. That's one thing we do have in common.
And thank you. I just want to say, by the way, it's always polite to compliment the host.
don't do it because it's polite.
No. I really do want to say that I loved your show on 702, and I must have been 12, but I feel like it made me more intelligent as a kid. So, yeah.
Are you sure it was my show?
I didn't. You know what? I didn't transition with you, admittedly, to 5FM because it just never felt. I was never convinced, and at the time didn't want to have anything in common with 5FM listeners. But since you started Cliff Central, and you've extended the platform beyond yourself, I think you've really realized a certain ingenuity that was probably stifled at all of those other radio stations. So well done.
Hey, if we can create great stuff together, then we're doing the right thing. Thank you both.
Okay.
Thank you.
There we go.
Great. Thank you. CliffCentral.com.
What a cool interview, huh? Mm. A lot of interesting comments as well on the social media and WeChat about that.
Very interesting.
It's just, you know, like we speak about empowerment. We talk such a good game around empowerment, but we seldom do it like even in our own homes, basically.
You know, we talk a good game about most things and then do absolutely nothing about it. It's a big problem that we have.
Yeah. Well, you can always change that, hey? So
yeah, definitely.
If you did miss the interview with Gareth and the ladies of the Maid Sessions, then CliffCentral.com with all the rest of it. Now, Michael, we have Gareth back tomorrow.
Very exciting stuff. We're all getting our presents tomorrow.
Yes, we definitely are. We're getting amazing presents tomorrow. Wow, that's so incredible. I'm going to bring a big bag. Yeah, that's what I'm going to do tomorrow.
Okay, all right. I just don't want you guys to be disappointed.
No, disappointment's going to come tomorrow, but let's still be excited a bit.
Yeah, my buddy. Stop being such a wise old hen.
Okay.
If he does one of those things where he puts all of the gifts in one bag and he says, guys, put your hand in and pick something out. Nah, I'm not down for that. I want the best gift.
No, it will be, Michael. It will be because we've worked hard. We've worked hard without him being here, so it'll happen. I can see the prophecy playing out. Sia, what are you expecting to get from Gareth?
Pure love. That's
Wow,
all.
that is sucking up if I ever heard.
Of course.
Okay. Well, that's pretty much it for today. I did have a clip, and then oh, no, here it is. For six, yeah, and no, that's not. It's great. Oh, I had a clip I was going to play you about honest politicians and that kind of stuff. So I have to wait until tomorrow, unfortunately. But yeah, we've got another power day ahead here on CliffCentral.com. Then we've also got the Renegade Sessions, which is the Renegade Report, which will take place at the end of today's broadcast from 6 until 7 p.m. today. If you miss anything, CliffCentral.com. And if you missed anything from early in the show, we'll just pick up the podcast. Michael, is part one up?
Part one is up.
Okay, very good. And Anushka, you wanted the song details earlier from a song that I played. It was Flight of the Conchords. What's Wrong with the World Today? Something along those lines. I forget the title now.
What happens towards the end of that song? I mean, it sounds as if they
just
sort
harmonize.
Of forget to sing. Properly.
No, they pretty much...
And it just becomes like noise making. But I like it. It's a cool song.
That's kind of what the Flight of the Conchords are, really. They're a parody band. They parody themselves.
Okay, I get it.
Which is really fun. And they're really cool. They had a TV show a while back. And the TV show was basically them going to America to try and make it. So they're two guys from New Zealand who are now living in New York. But they're doing so. It's quite awkward because they're trying to get noticed, but they have no decent music and they're playing these shitty little bars and they just sing their way through their lives. So the episodes will go like any other sort of sitcom, whatever, and then they'll just describe something, but they'll have a song around it. And then all of the songs became an album, and that's what these guys did. It was a very different take on comedy, and they were a big deal for a couple of years. They traveled the world. They were always kind of off-center. They're always pulling the piss out of themselves, and they're really, really funny. But another show, seeing as we just got a couple minutes now, I really enjoy comedy. I love the science of comedy. I love what makes people laugh and the thought process goes into it and what makes brilliantly funny people tick. So I was watching this thing just from a while back about Family Guy's 200th episode. Now, Family Guy is a rough show, right? It's very un-PC. A lot of people either love it or hate it because it can be quite offensive to people. You know, everyone gets offended nowadays. But this, just listen to how these what these guys made about the show. It's like they wanted to create a show which literally was the most jokes and the funniest jokes possible into one show that they could possibly cram into it. So even if it wasn't related to a story or a particular episode, they'd have these cutaways and they'd do these things. And I found it kind of inspiring how people always say, oh, like, get a real job, or, you know, you have so much time to make up all this shit, that there are people who are creating so much, like, joy and funny stuff out there. And Father Concord, same kind of stuff, you know. These people will never be household names. They'll never be massive stars. But they create this funny stuff that's going to be funny for years and years to come. Just like Family Guy episodes, they still are. Like, so inspired. I've even got Brian the dog. That's my head cover for my driver. And he presses paw and he says things.
Yeah, he's great. I love that show. Rough. I mean, I don't find it that rough, though. There are rougher shows that I've seen, animated shows.
Mops, there is a scene where Peter Griffin is standing outside of an abortion clinic, and everyone's protesting about pro-life, and this, and then this guy goes, excuse me, sir, have you got time to watch a video that we've made about anti-abortions? And he goes, yeah, sure, my wife is having an abortion. I've got time to kill. Trust me, that show is rough. There is some there's like an entire like song and dance about a guy who just got AIDS, and like... They push every possible boundary there, and they have been doing so for years and years. It's just incredible how, I mean, this kind of stuff will never, ever be on TV here.
I love the grumpy baby. Is it Stewie?
Stewie, yeah.
He's got,
his voice is so funny.
He's got major issues, but I love him.
Yeah, it's such a good show. If you haven't watched it or you haven't really got into it, a lot of people watch it and they go, this isn't for me, but it really is just so good. And there's so many different characters, and they get into every single different facet of life because there's so many different characters. And Brian the dog, he's my favorite. Like, he really is. He's just so funny because he's like an adult man who's also, but he's a dog, of course.
Oh, hi, Brian.
Hey, you didn't forget about our date, did you?
Of course not. I was just thinking, since it's so nice out, we could go out for a run and then eat.
Oh, yeah, no, you know, I would totally do that. I've already run, like, so many K today.
Oh, come on, don't be a wimp. This way you'll earn your dessert. Wow, this is great, isn't it, Brian?
Yeah, it's awesome. Hey, is your vision also reduced to just a tiny pinhole?
Just push through it, Brian. Once you hit your runner's high, you'll catch your second wind.
Runner's high?
Yeah. My endorphins always kick in at the top of this hill.
Oh, crap.
So Brian's always, like, hooking up with hot chicks, and Brian's a dog.
Brian, I know.
Your heart. What the hell do you think you're doing? Stop. Brian, this is your penis. Don't listen to him. We're this close to Bone City.
Brian, I'm here too. I'm hanging out with your penis and your heart.
Okay, here comes the top.
Chloe, I'm not sure I can... I feel it. I'm feeling the runner's high.
It was a beautiful day. Sun beat down. I had the radio on.
Go get him, Brian. And by the way, the sun is really a black guy.
The moon is Korean.
Wow. This is amazing. I never want to lose this feeling.
Oh, Brian, that was incredible.
Yeah, you humper real good, Brian.
I'm going to go ahead and close the shades.
There's a Korean moon telling a dog to really hump this chick. Like, it's just a weird show, but it's just so funny from start to finish. And if you haven't gone into that show in the past, it's been going for years and years now, I really recommend you do. It's still funny. You can find old series. It's just funny, it's good, and I will recommend it. Bubs, we are out of time for today. Tomorrow, Gareth will be back here in studio.
Yay.
Big day ahead. We're going to finish off with a song, Michael, a very special song. Tell us about it.
This got sent in by one of our listeners, Benita. She's also one of our piece of ass competitors. Is that the correct
contestants?
Contestants.
right? If you want to be part of the Pizza Ass Contest, as long as you have an ass, then you're in. So you're all sexes, all breeds, all animals. If you've got an ass, you can be part of our Piece of Ass. Just email mike@cliffcentral.com. So catch you tomorrow. This is Benita's song. It's Yellow Wolf, Best Friend, featuring Eminem and some other guy.
Some other guy.
Perhaps I can't do it all.
Okay.
So catch you tomorrow. CliffCentral.com.